Welcome to Leonard Lopate Weekend, where we bring you three of our favorite segments from the last week in case you missed them. You can find all of our segments on the WNYC app, our website at WNYC.org, or on iTunes. Just search for Leonard Lopate. And of course, you can also listen to us live on the radio every weekday starting at noon.
Listening to the Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
In an age of rapidly expanding income inequality, people are figuring out ways to do more with less, invoking ideas of self-reliance and simplicity embodied by people like Thoreau, Gandhi, the Quakers, and the Amish. In The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America, Mark Sundin follows three couples in Missouri, Michigan, and Montana who are living off the land while practicing their own versions of simple living. It's published by Riverhead Books, and I'm very pleased that it has brought Mark Sundin back to our show. Welcome back.
Thank you.
How would you describe the concept of simple living?
For these people, it's this idea of living in ethical resistance to what they see as an unjust state or an unfair economy, but doing that in a way that doesn't make them crazy, in a way that brings joy to their life.
How different is it than what survivalists do?
Well, survivalists who I met during my research, I felt they were really motivated by fear. They were awaiting the collapse so that they could then outlast it. And I started to consider, well, that to me is kind of a paranoid vision of the future. And I was interested in people who were either trying to prevent the collapse by changing the world, or in Detroit, people who are responding to the collapse.
How is simple living different from the local movement?
I would say the two things are pretty close. Local food is just sort of an appropriate technology to get food that doesn't impact the world in a terrible way. And of course, local economy is a way to not be dependent on the banks that seem to be destroying us in our freedoms.
But you also deal with some common myths about buying locally sourced food.
Yeah, I guess one of those myths is that you can buy your way into happiness. And, you know, part of the problem with local food is it can be quite expensive. And then you find yourself needing more money, and then you have to get another job. And then you're getting deeper into that cycle of earning and spending.
In the first part of the book, you highlight the Possibility Alliance, the PA, a radical back-to-the-land movement that was founded by Ethan and Sarah Hughes. Who are they?
Well, she was a classically trained opera singer who attended Grinnell College. He was a marine biologist and an outdoor educator, and they were out living in Oregon, homesteading, and they were kind of part of a environmental activism movement, marching in Seattle during the WTO. But eventually they decided they want to take it a step further, and they wanted to remove themselves from all industries that they found harmful. So they decided they weren't going to use any petroleum products or electricity. And that's how they found their way to an off-the-grid homestead in Missouri.
La Plata, Missouri. Well, sounds like they're doing a version of Amish life.
Absolutely. In fact, they chose La Plata, Missouri because there were Amish people there and they figured they could learn from them. They bought an old Amish farm. But, you know, what was interesting to me about them is they weren't raised Amish. They weren't even raised Christian, per se. But they have embraced that lifestyle.
And they've actually produced a mission statement?
Oh, yeah. To them, it's a movement to really change the world. They spent 2 years living on a Gandhian community in France, which was also off the grid. But it's not a sense of dropping out. It's rather sort of rehearsing, if you will, a way to make direct action, to use nonviolence to change the world.
And you said they don't use petroleum products because that causes pollution?
No, it's more like it causes violence. This is a Gandhian way of looking at nonviolence. If the petroleum industry is using war or displacement of indigenous people to get the oil, then my buying it is, in fact, financing that violence.
Well, what are the challenges of this kind of living? You have to, do you still wind up going into town?
They do go into town on their bicycles, which is 6 miles to a tiny town and then 14 miles to the college town. And that can be prohibitive, especially now that they have two small children. But I guess there's two types of hardships. The first is the physical of, you know, having to heat your house by chopping wood and putting it in the log stove, or having to heat water in order to bathe, having to milk the cows and work in the garden. But they really love that. That doesn't seem like a hardship.
You mentioned that many volunteers have spent weeks or months at the PA, but after almost a decade, only one other person has signed up to live that way full time. Has that been a source of stress for Ethan and Sarah?
It's been a disappointment because they get 1,500 visitors per year who just kind of gush and they say, this has been a life-changing experience. I love this place. I love what you stand for. But they don't want to take that step. But that step requires giving away all of your money.
Also, but also would require Ethan and Sarah to kind of tweak their concept, perhaps, or compromise some of their beliefs.
Yeah, they're absolutely dedicated to this, to Gandhian nonviolence, and they're not really willing to compromise.
And how did you feel when you spent time at the PA? Was it difficult?
It was. I mean, it was difficult just in the physical sense that it was really hot and there was no air conditioning or ice cubes. But it was also difficult to realize the degree to which I'd become dependent on technologies. For instance, the internet, and like how much time I spend feeling bad about myself, comparing myself to other people, thinking my career is a failure. And I sort of like pick at that scab online.
Well, let's see if your career is a failure. Mark Sundin is a contributing editor to Outside Magazine and a creative writing professor at Southern New Hampshire University. His latest book is The Unsettlers, In Search of the Good Life in Today's America, published by Riverhead. You also mentioned people like Wendell Berry and Scott Nearing, who have written books about early advocates of simple living. How did their experiences shape their messages?
Yeah, the Nearings and Wendell Berry are really the grandparents of this movement, and they've combined the sort of simplicity concept of working with your hands and doing work that makes you feel good and makes you feel like you've achieved something, combining that with this ethical boycott of the financial industry, the oil and gas industry, the industrial food industry.
You also profile Greg and Olivia, a couple who are running Brother Nature Produce in Detroit. What's their story? How did they meet?
They met at a farmer's market. You know, what brought me to Detroit was interviewing all these preppers who were preparing for the collapse. And so I said, well, let me examine the collapse firsthand. And that's how I met
the collapse of Detroit, because it was declaring bankruptcy, or it declared bankruptcy.
Right, right. So Olivia grew up in Detroit. She's black, and her dad had kind of disappeared in the crack epidemic. And through her hard work and through her great mother, she got a scholarship to college. She came back to Detroit and had her dream job as a horticulturalist at the conservancy there on Belle Isle. And all this training she'd done to sort of get ahead, play by the rules, she just watched it crumble as the city went bankrupt.
Is the city encouraging locally sourced products as a result of the bankruptcy? Is it trying to reinvent itself?
The city is in such a mess that it's hard to tell what they're encouraging. They did recently allow people to buy vacant lots from the city specifically to farm on them. So I think they are moving in that direction.
Well, Detroit, of course, had a big inner city, but it also wealthier people lived in the suburbs. What place does the creation of the suburbs have in this narrative?
Well, the creation of the suburbs was a government subsidy which resulted in white flight, and it also resulted in the decimation of black neighborhoods, specifically freeways were built with tax dollars to ease the commute for the white folks and meanwhile destroy the neighborhoods that the black folks have been building for decades.
Greg grew up the son of a Ford factory worker. Were both of his parents were Ford factory workers?
His father and his great both of his great grandfathers had worked for Ford.
But he became an anarchist punk rocker?
Yeah, he grew up in the suburbs.
How does he go from there, from being a would-be member of MC5 into living the simple life?
You know, as a teenager, he would come in from the suburbs to downtown Detroit, and he just loved the scene and the punk rock. And he, in his college years, actually founded an anarchist collective. And it was all about breaking down racism and sexism. And from there, he became a public school teacher for 15 years. And sort of as a final bit of disillusion with that, he told me that, he said, I used to think I could change the world through public education. Now I think I can do it through local
school. So how much land do they have?
They have, they farm on a city block, which is about 14 vacant lots. And they've recently bought some more traditional farmland about 25 miles out of the city. And so they're now farming both of those lots.
Well, and I'm sure they're not bicycling. The third couple is Lucy and Steve Elliott from Victor, Montana. You spent time with them. How did they come to live in a teepee in a place like Victor, Montana?
Lucy had gone to graduate school in environmental studies at the University of Montana in the early 80s. And she became so frustrated with what she saw as a bunch of academics twiddling their thumbs that she dropped out of school and started to work on this organic farm where she met Steve, and they eventually became the owners of it.
And they seemed to be very idealistic but not dogmatic about how they would make a living and raise their family. Do all of these the couples have guiding principles that they try to live by?
Absolutely. I mean, Steve and Lucy named one of their kids Wendell. That's how inspired by Wendell Berry they were in his vision of small-scale agriculture.
So but what differentiates them from the other two couples that you profile?
Really, the main thing is how long they've been at it. These other two couples have young children, whereas, and you never know what'll happen once those kids get into high school age or college age. Steve and Lucy have been doing this for 35 years. They had that first baby in the teepee in Montana, but now they've succeeded by even conventional standards.
I'm speaking with Mark Sundin. His book, The Unsettlers in Search of the Good Life in Today's America, it's published by Riverhead Books. We'll continue our conversation after this. We're back with Mark Sundin, a contributing editor to Outside Magazine and a creative writing professor at Southern New Hampshire University, author of a number of books. This, the one we're discussing, is The Unsettlers in Search of the Good Life in Today's America. It's published by Riverhead Books. We have people living near Detroit, but Detroit, which is not a typical city. But then we've been talking about Lucy and Steve Elliott, who live in Victor, Montana, which I assume is rather isolated area. And yet one of their children decided to go to Parsons School of Design here in Manhattan.
Yeah, he'd never been to New York, and he decided that this is what he wanted to do, was to be an artist. And I felt like it was almost like Steve and Lucy were being punished for their hubris, because they had raised their kids with so little money and with so little pop culture, and they'd kind of instilled in them this work ethic and this simplicity, and here he comes to New York.
And has he done okay? How has he survived without the skills that most Americans would have had?
He's done really well here, but there's a funny story that he showed up and he picked up a key to an apartment he had found on a Craigslist, and he got there and he realized he had never in his life used a key to open a door. And then the key broke off in the lock, so he was stuck.
You describe Lucy and Steve Elliott as butting up against big organic. What's that?
Well, they were doing organic before it had that name. This was in the early 80s. They were the pioneers. And then when organic certification came along, they started to get certified. And after 15, 20 years of that, they had this libertarian streak. And they said, you know, we don't need the government coming in here and looking at our stuff and giving us a gold seal of approval. We're just going to self-regulate. And they changed the name from organic to homegrown.
Mm. And has that been okay for them?
It's been great. The stores that they supply to have such trust in them that they're okay with it. And they've managed to just not have to be under the yoke of that government regulation.
You write that places like Brooklyn, Portland, and Missoula have, now that they've been discovered as cool, have become prohibitively expensive places to live. Do you see particular regions or cities in America that are on the cusp of being discovered like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, all through the Midwest and the West, you know, all the college towns have sort of been insulated against the recession. And as a result, these kind of farmers markets and farm-to-table stuff is popping up. And it's getting too expensive to be a farmer anymore.
How is all of this different from the Back to the Land movement that was in the 60s?
I mean, that's where it started, has the same ideals. I think what's different to me is it doesn't feel like these people are dropping out. It feels like these people are very engaged with what they see as society's biggest failings, and they're trying to fix them.
But they are dropping out to some degree if they're living in isolated places.
Well, sure, but you know, the farm in Victor, Montana is only 30 miles from Missoula, so they have a market to sell to that close. And of course, Detroit is not the middle of nowhere.
You also discuss your desire to live simpler and your discussions with your wife on where you'd both like to live and what kind of life you envision. Can you tell us about those talks?
Sure. I mean, you start to want to change one thing in your life. It's like pulling a thread and it comes apart. For me, I was so angry about the banks, and then I found myself, you know, every month writing a mortgage check to Bank of America. But to change that was going to we'd have to reevaluate our whole life. So at this point, my wife's in graduate school, so we're kind of in a holding pattern, but we do have that acre of land out in Utah. Maybe we'll end up there.
Well, this is not just a commitment of one person. If we're talking about married couples or couples, then two people have to agree to an awful lot of things, and that can be kind of difficult.
Yeah, and as it turned out, I got married during the period of writing this book. And this book is about people who have volunteered to embrace limitations instead of try to get everything. And they found a deeper abundance, and that's kind of how I see marriage.
Did you learn anything from these couples that you can apply to your own life?
Yeah, I think that's it right there is, you know, we have a society that encourages us to gratify every desire. And if you can think of something you want, we'll sell it to you. And these people have opted out of that.
Would you have to come up with a fourth way, or is one of these couples kind of a role model?
Well, all of these people have chosen to do something that they absolutely love. They're not wearing a hair shirt and suffering. And I don't really love farming the way they do, but I do feel like I've been so lucky to find work that I do love, which is writing, and, you know, more or less make a living at it.
These couples are all producing something, so this is kind of a return to the way things used to be. You settled down on the land, you grew things, or you made something by hand, sold it, and that paid for the rest of the other necessities of life.
Yeah, and with the decline of, you know, family farms and manufacturing and the ascent of the so-called information economy, I think a lot of us sit at a screen all day and wonder what we've achieved at the end of the day.
You'd have to give up teaching if you did this.
That's true. Mm-hmm. And again, I think I'm better at teaching than I am at farming. So,
and would you stay with Outside Magazine?
I think I would. I mean, I think that I have more to offer as a writer than I do as a farmer.
Just one thing. Often in these kind of utopian approaches, there's been a religious aspect. Does that play a part in the lives of these couples?
In some, but not all. Ethan and Sarah are Quakers, so they've really embraced that simplicity and that kind of, I would call, radical Christianity. And they're big disciples of Gandhi. But it's not a requirement.
Mark Sundin, the book, The Unsettlers in Search of the Good Life in Today's America, is published by Riverhead Books. Thank you so much for being on our show again.
Thanks for having me.
Donald J. Trump will take the oath of office tomorrow, an event that has many Democrats and progressives asking, what do we do now? Longtime activists Becky Bond and Zach Exley, two of the top advisors on volunteer mobilization for the Bernie Sanders campaign, have given that question a lot of thought, and their new book, Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything, provides a clear blueprint for organizing and mobilizing people for political change in the digital age. Prior to joining the Sanders campaign, Becky Bond served as political director at Credo and is a co-founder of Credo Super PAC. Among other organizing jobs he's done, Zach Exley was a union organizer and then served as MoveOn.org's first organizing director in its 2003 campaign to prevent the war in Iraq. The book is from Chelsea Green Publishing, and I'm very pleased it's brought Becky Bond and Zach Exley to our show today. Hello.
Hello.
You wrote your book before the election. Were you surprised by the outcome?
Yeah. I mean, we actually, in our introduction, we both suggest that, you know, Trump does have a chance, and we were a little embarrassed, you know, as everybody became more and more sure that he had no chance. We were like, oh, people are going to laugh when this book comes out, but that we thought he had a chance. But yeah, like everybody, we were surprised and horrified.
for many people, the election's outcome came as a shock. But after reading this book, I'm struck by what I see as your optimism. Is that a fair reading? Are you optimistic about our immediate political future?
Well, I think we're optimistic about the American people and optimistic about the amount of work and the amount of spirit that volunteers are willing to put into taking their democracy back. But the challenges that we have in front of us with money in politics and with leaders that are not responsive to the people, it's a big challenge. But if there's ever been a time when the people, I think, have been ready to organize themselves and be articulate about what they wanted to do once in power, I think now is that time.
Zach, didn't you give up your job to work on the Bernie campaign?
Yeah.
And moved to Vermont?
Yes. I did. And but, you know, these—
What was your job?
I was starting a new business, actually, and back in Missouri, where I live, and it was just starting to take off. But then I had to get back into this presidential campaign thing because of Bernie.
Did you think he had a reasonable shot at winning the nomination?
I'll be honest, I didn't in the beginning, but I thought, you know, it was worth it anyways because the movements that come along with these presidential campaigns sometimes, and I think that's valuable in itself. But then, a couple months before Iowa, it started. You know, he was getting so high up in the polls, and the movement was getting so big I think all of us really thought he did have a chance.
Becky, didn't Zach talk you into quitting your long-term job at Credo to work on the Bernie campaign?
Yeah, he did. You didn't tell me back then that was how you felt.
No, how were you in contact?
So Zach and I were probably talking on the phone every day because Zach had been electrified by the crowds that were turning out for Bernie, and he decided to go to Washington, D.C. and get on the team, and he started calling me, and when I was hearing and I was seeing in the news about what was going on, I mean, I think I, like a lot of people, thought, you know, Bernie represented so many things that I cared about, urgent action to address climate, really wanted to deal with income inequality, with the big solutions. And I think, like a lot of people, we looked around and I said, you know, if enough people who actually believe this stuff supported Bernie and went to work, then he could actually win, right? And so I thought, well, I'm one of those people. I better go join the campaign if they'll have me.
But he was being dismissed in the press as a can't-win, long-shot candidate at the time. So I'm assuming you thought, well, we don't have much of a chance, but here's my opportunity to do certain things I've always wanted to do.
I mean, if there weren't so many people getting involved in the campaign, I thought he could win. I would not have quit my job if I didn't think that Bernie had a shot at winning. And really, you know, elections are won by turning out more voters than the other side. And I knew from my work that the most effective way, the gold standard for moving a voter to the polls, is a volunteer having an inspiring conversation with a voter in person at the door or on the phone. And with so many people willing to work for Bernie, I thought, gosh, we could actually talk to enough voters that he could win. And that's why I went to work for the campaign.
What were each of your roles in the Bernie Sanders campaign, Zach?
Well, we ran an experiment, basically, that was really kind of on the fringe of the campaign in the beginning. There's, you know, in presidential primaries, they care about those first four early states. And then there's 46 other states that the campaign typically does not care about. And so that was kind of the project that I carved out when I joined the campaign. And it was, you know, it's so important because there's hundreds of thousands of volunteers in those other states that want to participate. And so we built a program that allowed them to call into the early states and try to make a difference that way, but also organize their states for later.
And what about you, Becky?
Yeah, a lot of people think advisors, they think about policy or think about the soundbite. What Zach and I did every day was figure out how could we take all these people who wanted to volunteer and put them to work at tasks that would actually help Bernie win. And so we spent all of our time doing organizing, putting these volunteers into teams and into structures where they could actually accomplish big chunks of the campaign's national field plan.
Isn't it kind of iffy to rely on volunteers? Paid staff has a better sense of the mission, doesn't it?
Well, the thing is, we had 46 states that we were responsible for. And, you know, when you think about Iowa, they you know, Iowa typically gets 100 or 150 staffers or 200 maybe even for a serious presidential primary or for the caucuses. But we had 46 states. So it would have taken tens of thousands of paid staff to actually run a campaign. It's not possible. So that was our challenge, and that was what we really wanted to show was possible, that there is a way to organize volunteers to make them effective.
Didn't you work on the Howard Dean campaign?
Yeah.
That had a lot of volunteers as
yes,
well?
Yes, and that was a great lesson in how you can mobilize huge numbers of people and have that not add up to work that actually changes the outcome.
Your book's title, Rules for Revolutionaries, is an obvious play on the title of Saul Alinsky's book, Rules for Radicals. What's the difference between a revolutionary and a radical?
Well, we really wanted to update that classic of organizing, Rules for Radicals. In many ways, when Saul Alinsky wrote that book, and for your audience, Saul Alinsky is so influential with many of the organizers who are running community-based organizations today. It was really in a reaction to more radical movements. There were a lot of people were frightened by the Black Power movement and by people who called themselves communists. And Alinsky provided another way, which was to create these citizen organizations where paid organizers would go in and organize the people around sort of smaller incremental change, which was a lot less scary and also necessary. It was needed change. It was cleaning up public housing projects, or it was getting a stop sign on a street. But it really was about blunting the more radical influences of the people to make change through the kind of messy mass participation movements that have really changed our country many times. And so with as many urgent problems as we have and we're facing in this country and so little time to solve them, we wanted to go back to the kinds of mass participation movements that we had in the past.
Conservatives still invoke Alinsky's name as a pejorative.
It's kind of funny because there are all these, you know, books and shows that the right produces about how Alinsky was a communist, but he was actually an anti-communist. And it's funny that they're kind of they're having classes on learning the Alinsky model, as you know, but actually, you know, what we kind of believe is that the Alinsky model has really slowed down and wound down the progressive movement over the decades.
My guests are Zach Exley and Becky Bond. Their book, Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. Becky, how has the digital age changed the rules of organizing? What's the role of technology in the revolution you're writing about?
That's a really great question. You know, what we did in this presidential primary would not have been possible 4 years ago because of the rapid pace of the changing of technology. And there's all of these software platforms that in some ways, you know, make life kind of hard to live when you work for a company where you have to be always on. So it's not just email, but it's, you know, if you have Google Apps, you have platforms like Slack where you're always chatting with your coworkers and you're working, whether on vacation, whether at the office or it's the middle of the night. But in fact, these software platforms, most of which are free or extremely low cost, provide this excellent forum for getting volunteers, no matter where they live, no matter what time it is, in touch with each other and in touch with the campaign. So it allowed us to take these advances that are being used in business and basically globalizing the economy to use it to organize people to fight that.
People spend a lot of time creating, signing, and sharing online petitions for one cause or another. Are those petitions effective change agencies?
I think it's always worthwhile when someone wants to put their name on something and stand up for change. And what that often does is create a list of people that you know believes in something. But the next step has to come through, which is that you then have to be asked to do things in person to change things. You have to be asked to make a phone call, to show up at a meeting, right, to actually do something. And I think one of the advances of the Bernie campaign was that we show that if you ask people to do something big, to win something big, they're really ready to do more than just click on a button or put their name on something. They're really, or share something on Facebook. They're really ready to show up in person, to do work, and to come together to make change.
So the book is called Rules for Revolutionaries. Rule number one, Zach, is you won't get a revolution if you don't ask for one. Can you explain?
Yeah, well, that is what Bernie did, right? He said, we need a political revolution in this country. And he said, free college tuition, Medicare for all, and a bunch of other great stuff.
But didn't people react negatively to the word revolution?
Well, they didn't. That's the amazing thing. And I was always fond of the word revolution. And my friends, including a lot of progressives, would say, you can't say that. That's inflammatory. But it turns out that people really do feel like we need some serious change in this country, and revolution is a great word to reference that.
Central to the debate between Democrats during the primary season was, is a revolution even possible? Given today's rather political climate, is radical change of the sort you're proposing possible?
I think so, because, you know, here's the thing. We had a revolution in this country, and through it, we got this awesome democracy. And as much as progressives complain about how we get outspent and the voting systems have problems, if we organize a powerful enough movement, we can win. The Republicans have been showing us that for decades now. And right now, they control most of the state houses, governor's houses, and all that stuff. So yes, we can use our democracy to have an electoral revolution. And that's what Bernie was egging the country on to do.
Yeah, Beck, is it just really a matter of, as you put it in the book, making the big ask?
Well, certainly if you don't ask someone to do something big, they're probably not going to do it, right?
But you have to have a plan, don't you? You're asking them to do something.
Right. Well, of course it has to make sense. Look, the people are smart. And when we talk about, you know, there's been a lot of everyone is this, everyone that thrown around. And I think for those of us who travel in elite circles or in the media, we have this sense of who the everyone is. But I think the election of Donald Trump showed us that actually, you know what, we don't have as diverse of understanding of where people in this country are and what they're thinking about. And, you know, with an election, the plan to win is to turn out more voters than the other side. And so, in a sense, it's easier to talk about these organizing theories in relationship to an election. And we were able to give people a centralized plan to win, how to contact enough voters to make Bernie viable, right? That was our centralized plan to win, and let them work on it no matter where they were. But there's lots of other organizing challenges out there where people can come up with a plan, and if a lot of people get to work on it, whether it's knocking on doors or whether it's raising enough money or whether it's convincing an elected official to do something, people are smart. They can come up with these plans, and if the plan's smart enough, people will join them and make it happen.
Many of the pundits argued that incremental change is the best strategy, but you don't agree.
I mean, incremental change is usually the only kind of change you're going to get. But people don't fight for taking that one next step. They need to know where they're going. So you climb a staircase by taking a bunch of steps up the staircase. The way to mobilize a whole nation through a political movement is to say where you're going, not to talk about that very next step. And that was Hillary Clinton's big mistake.
Because incremental change means to a lot of people politics as usual, maintaining the status quo.
Well, people are busy, and people have a lot of stuff going on in their lives, and they need to know that what you're asking them to get involved in is worth their time and worth the time that they're going to take away from their kids and their jobs and all that stuff. So you need to say, here's where we're going, and it's going to be big and beautiful.
Some people have noted that both Bernie and Trump were reaching out to the same audience and had the same kinds of responses. Do you agree?
Well, I think they both were reaching out to all Americans in some ways. They weren't assuming that they had some small constituencies that they had to turn out and that they didn't actually have to give a big message to America. And I think that a lot of politicians in the parties are making assumptions about who their base is. And I think what we learned in this election is you can't make assumptions about people. You need to talk to them. You need to find out what's going on in their lives. And then you need to propose an agenda that speaks to what the country needs.
Given that Clinton won the Democratic primary and the Republicans won the White House and both chambers of Congress, do you think that American voters have an appetite for a big ask or for a revolutionary change?
Well, I do think so because – and I think that actually if you look at how the Republicans have come to power in this way – if you look at the way they organize at a grassroots local level, you know, this Christian conservative movement is it is a big ask. And it's this all-encompassing movement. It's actually very radical when you look at how they're organizing on a local level.
Is that what you're calling big organizing?
I think they do. I think if you look at the history of the Christian right organizing over the last several decades, I think it does have share a lot of the elements that we're talking about with big organizing. You know, they had a big vision for really changing the country, for organizing millions of people for really big goals. They, you know, in their meetings, in their books, in their organizing, they talked about where they wanted to be 50 years from where they started. They said, here's where we want to be 50 years from now. And they planned accordingly. And they built infrastructure. And they had a long-term view. And we have not seen that on the left or with the Democrats.
But it's interesting that after Barack Obama won his first election, everybody talked about how brilliant his organization had been and how it was changing the way political campaigns would be run. And now we're talking about the Democrats falling behind.
Yeah, well, I mean, the president really shut down his campaign organization once he was elected into office. And I think that people went home and thought that the president could handle everything, that he had it. And they went back to their lives. And I think what we learned then is that you have to stay engaged, that you can't count on the politicians, given how much influence money has on the system, to fall through unless the people are there to hold them accountable. And, you know, I want to say I do think that the people voted for really radical change. In this election, I think that President-elect Trump is promising very radical things. He put the CEO of Exxon not in charge of the EPA, but in charge of our whole foreign policy. Like, that's incredibly right. That's incredibly radical. And so, you know, the problem was that the Democrats didn't offer an alternative that promised enough change, and the people rolled the dice on Donald Trump, and now we're living with the consequences.
Yeah.
My guests are Becky Bond and Zach Exley. Their book, Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. And the title suggests that big organizing can change everything. Did your big organizing for the Bernie campaign change American politics, do you think?
Well, I think every one of these big movement presidential campaigns does change American politics over the past few cycles. You know, if you look at the Dean campaign, the Obama campaign, and the Bernie campaign, a lot of new stuff was discovered and invented, and the people that participate, you know, retain that experience. And, you know, we built on stuff that was developed by the Obama campaign. The problem with this presidential campaign phenomena is that it's contained in the campaign. And as soon as the campaign is over, the movement dissipates. And, you know, and that's as opposed to what we were just talking about with the right. And it's a much more broad, you know, and deeply rooted movement.
Well, the Dean campaign came to an end with that famous scream.
Well, it came to an end by
Trump
losing
Iowa.
But Trump
also had a whole bunch of things that would have been the equivalent of that big scream.
But this is the thing. It wasn't the scream. Dean came in fourth in Iowa. And, when you know, as the Clintons said, there's only three tickets out of Iowa. So the Dean campaign made a mistake in that it did not get organized in Iowa. That was a mistake that the Obama campaign corrected. But I think, but you're making a great point, which is why wasn't Trump disqualified? And the way, you know, by all of the horrible things that came out, the way I understand that is that he did disqualify himself over and over and over again, but voters were so angry about the status quo, and especially in those three states that gave him the presidency, Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, those people experienced their means of making a living be dismantled over several decades. And Clinton's brand was all over that dismantling. And so enough people said, I don't care if this guy is the devil, I'm going to vote for him because I'm so mad.
Hillary's also been faulted for not campaigning in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania.
She didn't go to a single UAW hall in Michigan during the campaign, which is almost impossible to do if you know Michigan.
If you had been advising her, would you have said you got to go there?
I think if anybody who was looking at the data and was at all in touch with what was going on with the American people, they would say, you got to get to Michigan, you got to get to Wisconsin and Pennsylvania, and you got to talk to those people about what happened to their means of making a living and what you're going to do about it.
Becky, what is distributed organizing?
Well, it's really interesting. On a lot of campaigns, people would call what Zach and I do as digital organizing. And, you know, that sort of conveys, you know, pictures of people, you know, at their laptops on Facebook, you know, sitting in some headquarters. And you know, for us, we weren't trying to get people to do things online. We were just using digital tools to get them to do things in the real world. And so it's sort of like when organizers started using the telephone instead of just having to go to someone's house. You didn't call them telephone organizers. So the idea about distributed organizing was really to actually bring what we do with technology back into the realm of the kind of field organizing that these campaigns are based on, but also to suggest that, you know, we can actually now, with the new technology we have, we can get a lot of stuff going in a lot of places and not have to be there all at once. And that's the distributed nature of the campaign that was so powerful and also so scalable. And that's a new thing in presidential politics.
And it relies on volunteers, as the earlier versions relied on volunteers. Is it important to still have people go door to door?
Absolutely. You know, having these conversations, and this comes back to Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania and sort of how the Clinton campaign wasn't connecting with voters. They made a decision not to run the large-scale kind of canvases where volunteers go door-to-door and they're bringing data back into headquarters, so there's a feedback loop between the voters and the campaign. And not only is it make the most impact on a voter to talk to them in person, they're more likely to go to vote, you're more likely to change their mind, but it also lets the campaign actually have a day-by-day, a very visceral connection to what's going on in the country outside of their headquarters. And our politicians are really lacking that today, which I think is how so many people got surprised.
Has the DNC asked you about your successes organizing all of those volunteers?
The DNC? I don't know. What's even going on at the DNC right now? I don't know.
I think
just imagine a bunch of zombies walking around in the hallways.
It needs to choose a head before it can even start moving forward.
You know, this is a good suggestion. We should send them a box of books because I think they're waiting. They have a leadership fight right now, and so I think a lot of things are on pause there. So I think that maybe they have time to do some reading.
We just got a big bulk order for our book by a state Democratic Party. I don't know if we should call out what state, but it. So we would.
One way or the other?
What do you mean? You mean in the election?
Yes.
No, it's in a red state. It's a red state. Yes. And so they ordered a bulk order of our book. So yes, any state parties out there, or the DNC? Yes, we'll ship you crates of the book.
A listener asks: is revolution the right word? It's been 100 years since the Russian Revolution. This sounds more like using democracy to achieve goals.
That's right. What we're talking about is a political revolution. While we still have our democracy, we want to use it to change who's in power so we can make the policy changes that we need. But let's be honest, you know, we're losing, you know, some of our democracy. It's not just the fact that we've lost the National Voting Rights Act in many ways, but we literally have places like Detroit or Puerto Rico where the bankers have bankrupted, you know, the citizenry, and then they've literally forced leadership, like political leadership. They're not run by elected officials anymore. And I think we have to be aware, if we don't have a political revolution, we may have to have a real one, or else we're going to lose our country.
Yeah, but so let's have a political one instead.
One of your rules, rule number 20, is get ready for the counter-revolution to include your friends.
Yeah.
Well, you know, when you want big change, you know, that's scary to a lot of people, even people, you know, that may agree with you. about what needs to happen. And, you know, there's so many people that said for Bernie, he could never, I agree with Bernie on the issues, but he can never win. And that's why they supported Clinton. And I think that if people, you know, need to understand that, you know, that they could be held back by people that are trying to tell them, hey, you're going to hurt the Clinton campaign, you shouldn't push for Bernie. But in reality, we showed it was possible for Bernie to win the primary. And had we started earlier and had fewer people been afraid to join the campaign that they agreed with, could have been a different outcome.
One of the evaluations of the 2016 general election is that the white working class in the Rust Belt abandoned the Democratic Party and voted for Trump. Has the Democratic Party lost the working class vote for good?
Well, we got to
keep... Is this the new normal?
The thing is, Trump was the most unpopular presidential candidate ever, right? And it's just that Hillary Clinton was... And Hillary Clinton was the second most unpopular. And like we were talking about, in those Rust Belt states, people were just so mad about their means of making a living being dismantled. You know, he had a message that got a few of those people to come out. So yes, the way, you know, the Democratic Party establishment lost those workers. I don't think it's just the white working class, though. You know, their turnout among working class people was lower for Hillary than for Obama across the board, across every ethnicity, every gender. It was lower for Hillary. And so, yeah. And the crazy thing is that Trump, as a Republican, you know, went completely against Republican Party policies and Republican ideology with his trade policy, with his industrial policy, and just about everything he said about economics. So if that's not a sign to the Democrats, you know, that this guy comes off of reality television and wins the presidency with what used to be the Democrats' economic message, if that's not a sign to the Democrats that yeah, they lost the working class, not just the white working class, that they lost the working class and that they can get it back just by talking about how to rebuild people's means of making a living, if that's not a sign, then I don't know what is. But we'll see if they get that message.
Bernie seemed to be rather reluctant to go very hard after Hillary during the campaign. Was that something that trickled down to the staff? And then the volunteers?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we, you know, Bernie was very clear to the staff that he didn't want anyone saying anything negative about Secretary Clinton. And in fact, we in our public meetings, we always referred to Bernie's fight against the billionaire-backed candidates, right? And so what we were doing is we were organizing people around a set of political ideals. And, you know, when we went to these, Zach and I traveled the country constantly meeting with volunteers and helping them set up these volunteer organizations. And whenever we met with them, we just said, we're not talking about the other candidates, what they're doing. We're talking about how to get to work to fight for the things that we believe in. And the campaign on the ground, as opposed to on Facebook, was very positive about the issues and what we were fighting for, not what we were fighting against.
Are you amused at all that Goldman Sachs, which was criticized on both sides, now is kind of dominate the new cabinet?
It's unbelievable.
It's unbelievable. You know, it's
a requirement for membership in the cabinet. You have to be from Goldman.
Goldman or a billionaire. You have to be one of the two or both.
Or better if you're both. You know, yeah.
Thanks to both of you, Becky Bond and Zach Exley. Their book is Rules for Revolutionaries, How Big Organizing Can Change Everything. It is published by Chelsea Green.
Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been 40 years since the Sex Pistols rocked the pop music world with punk anthems like Anarchy in the UK, God Save the Queen, and Pretty Vacant. Over that time, the legend of the Sex Pistols has grown, and the sound inspired many later punk rock, thrash metal, and alternative rock musicians. Although they lasted just 2.5 years and produced only 4 singles and 1 studio album, they're considered one of the most influential acts in the history of popular music. In a memoir called Lonely Boy, Tales from a Sex Pistol, Steve Jones, the band's co-founder, recounts the nihilistic songs and amphetamine-fueled music, offering a portrait of punk rock pioneer, a man who spent his troubled youth in class-conscious Britain. It was written with the help of Ben Thompson, and I'm very pleased it has brought Steve Jones to our show now. Welcome.
Hello.
You're incredibly open and self-reflective in this book, beginning with your rough childhood that included sexual abuse from your stepfather. Did you ever know your real father?
I didn't know him when I was young. I met him in 2008.
That late?
A friend of mine, a relation of hers, lived in Amsterdam, and he found a lot of people in the Second World War. That was his specialty, of finding people, and she pushed me to find my real father. I reluctantly, I didn't really want to do it, to be honest with you.
And what happened when you finally met him?
Was it
anticlimactic?
No, it was actually a good experience. I spoke to him on the phone a couple of times, and he was a bit sheepish at first. But when he left my mum, he found another lady when he was in Nottingham doing conscription in the army. I guess everyone had to do a year conscription back then in '50s, '55s.
We had a draft here as well.
Yeah, and he moved up there, got married, and he's had two boys and a girl that are basically my age. And I met him, and I went up. When we did a reunion tour in 2008, we did like 30 shows in Europe, festivals, and then I went up to Nottingham is where he lives. So I got on the train, arranged to meet him, and I met him at the train station, and we went to some cafe around the corner and talked for about 2 hours, and then I got on the train back, made a couple of phone calls a couple of weeks later, and one more, and that was it. Hmm.
Your childhood has been described as Dickensian. Was it hard to revisit some of the incidents that you write about here?
It wasn't news to me when I did the book. I was quite aware of all the things that I was putting in the book. It was no revelation when I was doing the book. But I was a bit skeptical about letting the whole world know about some of the incidents that happened in the book.
How do you think what happened affected the way that you continue to see the world?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with having an abusive stepfather and a mother who didn't really want to have a child. I was just an accident. And for whatever reason, you know, she did the best she could, but it was, I always felt like I had to, you know, get her attention. It wasn't like she was giving me love. I was longing for attention that was not really there. There was not a lot of nurturing going on.
So you spend a great deal of your youth on the streets of West London and Hammersmith and Shepherd's Bush, engaged in petty crimes, mostly thefts. What kinds of things did you steal, or as you say in the book, nick?
Anything that wasn't nailed down would go missing.
And how many times were you arrested?
Most of my convictions was when I was a juvenile. I had 14 arrests as a juvenile.
Is it true that you even stole music gear from David Bowie?
Yeah.
Wasn't he one of your inspirations? Why would you steal from him?
I don't know. I told you I couldn't keep my hands in my pockets.
How old were you when you actually picked up a guitar to learn how to play it?
Well, originally, the Sex Pistols was a band called Cutie Jones and the Sex Pistols, where I was singing. And we had
so that's before John Lydon?
That's before John. I was kind of singing. We had another guy, Wally, playing guitar. And I kept telling Malcolm McLaren to come down and see us play. And he finally come down. He said, "You shouldn't sing. Get rid of the ugly guitar player and audition for a singer." And that's what we did.
And you met, but it was you and Paul Cook were important factors in creating the Sex Pistols.
Yeah, absolutely.
How did you meet?
Well, me and Paul used to cross paths on the way to school when we were like 10, 11 years old. He used to go to one primary school. I used to go to the other one, and we were like skinheads, you know, so we had that connection, and we just became pals, and then we went to the same secondary school, which was Christopher Wren. in White City Estates, and we were inseparable, and we're still good pals today.
What music were you listening to at the time?
When we were skinheads, around 10, 11, like reggae, Tamla Motown, that kind of stuff, ska, blue beat.
So after you stopped being the lead singer, you found John Lydon, and you gave him the name Johnny Rotten?
Yeah, because he had rotten teeth.
Uh-huh. Did he like that?
And I just said, your teeth are rotten, and it just kind of stuck. I don't know if he liked it. I'm sure he likes it now. He never wants to change his name, so.
The Sex Pistols only recorded one album, but never mind the bollocks. Here's the Sex Pistols is one of punk rock's seminal records and ranked by Rolling Stone and other publications as one of the top albums of all time. Did you know that you had something special at the time that you recorded it?
No clue. I don't think you know anything when you're that young and you're stupid. I knew we made the record we wanted to make. We were happy with it, the outcome of it. But we didn't have any record company breathing down your neck. Oh, we don't hear a single. You need to get back in there. You know, record companies were kind of scared of us, to be honest with you.
Actually, you had been fired from two record labels.
Yeah.
The band already was extremely controversial because you swore on live television, and you were banned from playing live in many parts of England.
Yeah, because of the press that we got the day after we went on this TV show to Bill Grundy, where I swore on the TV, it went out live. Everyone was outraged, and it changed everything. It was actually the beginning of the end. As much fun as it was the first few days with all the attention, it was actually the beginning of the end.
On the other hand, it got you all that filth and the fury kinds of headlines. It made you notorious and probably helped as well.
It did help. Like I said, for a little while, it was you couldn't buy that kind of publicity.
Hadn't Queen originally been scheduled to be on Bill Grundy's show?
Yeah, we was signed to the same label, EMI, and we was rehearsing to do this Anarchy tour, which was us, the headline, in The Clash, The Damned, and Johnny Thunders and The Heartbreakers. And we was rehearsing in this cinema in Kilburn, and all of a sudden a limousine pulls up and says, come on, we're going to the Today Show. So we just stopped rehearsing, jumped in this limo, and went down there. And for whatever reason, I don't know why Queen couldn't. There was a lot of for whatever reason involved in that.
And why did you curse on the air?
Because the guy asked for it.
Mm-hmm. He lost his job, didn't he?
I'd curse at you if you started having a go at me.
No, I'm not going to encourage
you. I know you're not. I'm only kidding.
The Sex Pistols, the album's title was a problem. Didn't some people find the word bollocks offensive? The original title was God Save Sex Pistols. Why change that?
That from that to never mind the bollocks. It was a word that I always used to say, and I used to hear this guy who sold hot dogs on Piccadilly Circus. He would always say it, and I would always say it, and it just kind of stuck. It was kind of a street thing, you know. It was kind of a working class title, and I think that's why it stuck.
Did you see this as a kind of a rebellious act by people from the working class? Because Britain, no matter what anyone says, still kind of has a seriously entrenched class system.
Oh, yeah, they'll always be that. I mean, the only hope you had when I was young was either you was a footballer, you was in a rock and roll band, or you won the pools, the lotto, as you call it in America.
Can you talk about the 12-day tour of America in 1978 and what it was like playing in the Deep South?
It was very scary. Very scary. I get the concept of Malcolm McLaren. He wanted us to play all the places that most rock and roll bands, the norm, if you will, major cities, New York, L.A. We did play. The final show was probably the most normal show where people were kind of into it, a bit more broad-minded. But all the places like in Tulsa, the Bible Belt, and Texas, it was a nightmare. They came to see the circus. They didn't come to see rock and roll.
Well, there was a punk tradition in the United States at the same time, although it was less political than the British version. But that would have been mostly in cities like New York.
New York. I think it was only New York. The Stooges from Detroit, but most of the the other part of punk was New York City.
Did they influence you?
The New York Dolls influenced me. You know, I was
Buster Poindexter.
When he went went on to be, yeah. But the first New York Dolls album was an album that was one of the albums that I used to play along to learn to play guitar, because I found it simple, but good enough for me to kind of pick up on.
Sid Vicious, who'd replaced Glenn Matlick in the band, could barely play his instrument and was later a full-blown junkie, and yet he had charisma, and he's become an icon, although it may have as much to do with the fact that he killed somebody.
Supposedly killed somebody.
Didn't you wind up playing all the bass tracks on the album because they didn't think that he was doing the job?
Well, God intervened. He made Sid go into hospital because he had jaundice. So I played all the bass on it.
And you say he may have killed somebody?
There was no proof that he did it.
Can you wound up in San Francisco during that American tour. Why did the band implode?
It was a build-up from the 12 days that we was in America. It was, coming to the U.S., for me, it was like going to Mars. You know, we was just used to grimy old London, and all of a sudden we're in this massive country where the roads are bigger, there's billboards. It was like, it was like coming to a space. I couldn't get it. But all the people that kind of got on in the bandwagon, all these High Times were trying to film Sid shooting up when no one was looking, and all these other magazines were all trying to get the exclusive. They were trying to keep the media ball rolling, and it was too much.
You had your own battles with heroin and alcohol, but you've come out of the other side of it by moving to the United States and changing your life.
Yeah,
you came to New York, and now you're in Los Angeles.
I lived in New York for a year before I drifted out to Los Angeles.
The Sex Pistols original lineup reformed for a couple of tours, around 1996, I guess. Was the chemistry still there?
The shows were great. It was just the other 22 hours in the day that was a nightmare. You know, we played better than ever. You know, really good.
And you're still playing?
Not really.
You become a well-known figure with your popular radio show called Jonesy's Jukebox?
Yeah.
And that's in Los Angeles. Can you tell us a bit about that?
Yeah, I started in 2003. I kind of stumbled on it. It was a fluke how I stumbled on it. And I did that for 5 years on a station called Indie 103.1. That folded in 2008. I went on to K-Rock for a couple of years on a Sunday night. But that didn't, 2 years, no one listens. And now I'm on KLOS, the classic rock station. 95.5.
You like being a DJ?
I do. I like having somewhere to go every day.
And now you've written this book.
Yeah. Now I'm an author.
You have a lot of, there's a lot of attention being paid to this book, a lot of good reviews. It's called Lonely Boy, Tales from a Sex Pistol, published by DiCapo, and my great thanks to Steve Jones for coming by to talk about it.
I just want to add, I did the audio for it too.
Okay.
It's my voice doing the audio.
Well, it probably sounds better that way than having an actor do it.
A
little more authentic.
Even though it was really hard to do it.
Really?
It took me 60 hours. I wanted to kill myself.
Well, then I guess I won't ask you to co-host this, fill in for me when.
No,
when
that, I, radio's, when I, radio's fine. Like I do it, I do that. But doing a book, I didn't realize how hard that was going to be.
Yeah. Well, I'm glad that you didn't kill yourself and that you were able to come by. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us, mate.
Thanks for listening to Leonard Lopate Weekend. We'll be back live on the radio on Monday at noon, and be sure to follow us on Twitter at Leonard Lopate or at facebook.com/LeonardLopateWNYC. Enjoy the rest of your weekend.